Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Monday. It's the 30th of January. Here in the third hour, Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us here in Studio A. Now, there's a conversation when I was on vacation with our guest host at the time, Dr. Ken Sherb, about Dietrich Bonhoeffer in this vein. We're going to pick up kind of where we left off there, talk a little bit about Christians, governmental authority, and whether or not there is such a thing as godly resistance to that authority. Dr. Uwe Simonetto here with us in Studio A for about the next 40 minutes, and then we'll round off today's program talking with Ed Martin, an attorney in St. Louis, about the Illinois and Missouri pharmacists, their refusal to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill, and the various reprisals they have suffered. Now, a complaint and a lawsuit filed in Illinois and in Missouri, respectively. And Ed Martin is a party to both of those. We'll be talking about that in the last 20 minutes of Issues, Etc. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest. He's an international journalist, director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. And he's author of a forthcoming article in the Lutheran Witness titled, Welcome Home, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now, before we go on with Uwe, I did want to mention there is a website you want to visit from our guest in the last hour, the last conversation, Pastor Dan Krieger. He's got a website, www.gospeltherapy.com. Visit that, www.gospeltherapy.com. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be back.
Okay, you were talking before about Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Right.
And if you would just give us a very brief preview of the predicament in which Bonhoeffer and many others in Nazi Germany found themselves. And then, if you would, let's talk about some of his approach to governmental authority, such as it was in Nazi Germany.
Right.
And his resistance.
Right.
To that, and your take on it.
Well, he had a twofold predicament. One was as a churchman, when the so-called German Christian movement, these were the pro-Nazi Protestants, really threw out basic tenets of our Christian faith, and that includes, of course, the Jewish roots of Christianity, the Old Testament. And when they endeavored to kick out Jewish-born pastors, and of course that is a theological absurdity, and Bonhoeffer resisted that along with other leading members of the confessing church, both Lutheran and non-Lutheran. Karl Barth, of course, was the other leader. That was one predicament. The other predicament was that Bonhoeffer very clearly saw that the Nazi regime was an evil regime. He had a personal predicament in that he was had actually gone to America and was promised a stellar position as a professor at Union Theological Seminary. And he could have lived here wonderfully, could have avoided military service and all these things. But then after a few days realized that he made a mistake and that his calling was to return to Germany and to suffer with the Christians in Germany, the fate that he expected they would suffer and that they did indeed suffer.
Why did he do that, if I can interrupt you? Why did, given the opportunity not only to spend the war in the United States, because everyone knew what was going on,
right,
to avoid returning to Hitler's Germany, and to, on top of all that, basically be received here as with a lot of accolade and probably a great advancement of his career, why go back?
Well, out of solidarity for his suffering fellow man, and in this particular case, his suffering fellow Christians, the real Christians, not the pro-Nazi Christians, and out of his conviction that you had to take a hand in changing the situation that was going on there, he became fairly convinced that Hitler was not the Antichrist, but he was a tool of the Antichrist, or what Luther called the Beowulf, and therefore had to be removed. And he got involved in these actions, A, to remove him, B, to maintain links with other Christians and others in the Western world, especially in Britain. C, to actively engage in helping Jews out of the country, out of Germany, and not only helping them out of the country, but actually getting their belongings out of the country. And to be a witness, but a witness in this particular case as a citizen in what we Lutherans call the left-hand kingdom. Because he, by that time, of course, he had already been barred from preaching and presiding and services, because of his writing, or from even publishing. He was in effect no longer an active pastor in the sense that we know an active pastor to be. He wasn't defrocked because you couldn't defrock him, but I mean, he was that. So he got involved with the German resistance, and there chiefly, and there actually essentially with the German military intelligence services, which were in the hands of anti-Nazis, Admiral Canaris and General Oster, which allowed him to travel freely around the world in Sweden and other places, to maintain contacts with the quote enemy, in this particular case England, and also to go up to Norway, which was by then occupied by the Germans and under a pro-Nazi regime under a man called Quisling, and to strengthen the resistance of the Lutheran State Church of Sweden against Quisling. So all these actions were essentially political actions, and he did not die. He was, in a sense, persecuted for his theological resistance against Hitler by not being allowed to preach and to publish. But he was not executed for that. He was executed for, quote, treason, unquote, because he acted actively against the government in place.
I want to come back to his execution, what led up to that, his imprisonment as well. But I've been reading most recently Winston Churchill's memoir of the Second World War. Yeah. And he talks quite a bit about now Churchill had, after the war, opportunity to review all of the archives of the Nazis. And he kind of made himself an expert on what was going on in Germany when we didn't know what was going on in Germany exactly. Hitler seemed all-powerful. And one of the things that I learned was that Hitler's advance across Europe always began, at least early on, as kind of a political advance. He was getting the Nazi Party greater influence in neighboring countries, Czechoslovakia and elsewhere. And if he could take over politically with his agents in the parliaments of the other nations of Europe, he was happy to do that. Yeah. And then walk in as a victorious hero to the cheers of the crowds. So it sounds like Bonhoeffer's concern was far more than just for his own German nation, but for his fellow Christians and his fellow citizens in Europe.
Yes, for the Christian civilization as such. And it seems, you know, up to a point, had Hitler not made, now in quotation marks, please, the mistake of not occupying Britain, chances are Germany would have won the war. And chances are there would not be a single Jew alive. And chances are that in all these nations you would have pro-Nazi governments. I mean, there were plenty of fascists in Britain, not just Oswald Mosley, there were others. And there was an undercurrent of sympathy for the Hitler regime, in part because the Hitler regime acted against against communism, which was godless, but in part also because they were racists. And we know what has happened in other countries like France and in Holland. You know, the Dutch often play themselves up as the great leaders in the resistance, but actually the treachery was quite phenomenal in the Netherlands, as it was in other. The best, the country that most resisted Hitler was probably, most effectively, was probably Denmark. So he would have been very successful in that and then effectively destroyed Christianity. Now, let me just move on to another leader of the resistance just for a second, because that is important. He was the mayor of my hometown, and I'm very friendly with his daughter still, who is a very old lady in Heidelberg. His name was Karl Gerdler. He would have become the Chancellor of Germany had the coup attempt against Hitler succeeded. Now, Gerdler resigned his mayor's post in 1936 out of protest against the Nazi outrages, especially the blowing up of the Mendelssohn Monument in Leipzig, and then traveled around the world warning the Americans and the British and others, but primarily the Anglo-Saxons, of Hitler's intentions. And one of his key statements was that Hitler was the Allies, the Western Allies, should not take Hitler as a potential ally in the struggle against the Bolshevism, because he said Hitler was a Bolshevist. And what he was his plans were to first destroy all the Jews, then, this is a quote from Gerdler, then destroy Christianity, and then ultimately destroy capitalism, and then institute a form of national socialism. Nazi means none other than national socialism, a collectivist society with a bogus religion, tribal religion, which was based on race. And that pretty much sums it up. Christianity would have been destroyed.
So Gerdler's approach was different than that of Bonhoeffer's.
Right.
His was more kind of an itinerant, in quote here, a prophet warning people. We're not just dealing with quote unquote mere fascism. We're dealing with a man who has designs upon the destruction of Western civilization, period.
Right. But Gerdler did more than that. He didn't just warn people. He also actively plotted along with General Beck and other old military leaders, the overthrow of the Nazi regime. The one difference between, and not only that, in a very Lutheran sense, he said, before we can even consider overthrowing a regime, we have to have a parallel administration in place that can immediately take over so as to avoid chaos. So he actually drew up lists all the way from the president, which would have been the grandson of the last emperor, right down to the local county executive, you know, here in St. Louis County, something like that. All these positions were already in place. And had they succeeded in toppling Hitler and the Nazis, then they would have had a functioning government, because Gerdler, like Luther, said that if you replace an evil government, you must be able to immediately continue functioning in an orderly fashion, because if you don't do that, you have chaos, and chaos is, of course, worse than even a bad regime, because chaos would bring the universe or the state of the world back to a pre-creation state. But Gerdler was against the assassination of Hitler initially, although he in the end concurred with the co-conspirators of 1944. But he wanted the military to arrest Hitler and have him tried for treason. And interestingly enough, the German military at the time, those who were engaged in this conspiracy, never intended a military dictatorship to take over. What they did do was to remove the obstacle to civilized behavior, national behavior of Germany, and then immediately replace that obstacle by a legitimate civil government, probably led by a monarch. But
so the hope there was, in essence, to kind of bring back the German monarchy. But moreover, the goal was not, first and foremost, let's get rid of Hitler.
Yeah. No, the constitutional monarchy, never an absolutist monarchy.
But the goal being there, it's not just we want Hitler dead. It's arrested, tried under existing law, and then disposed of however the
under
the
German criminal law, you see. And the interesting thing here is that, you see, my father was a prosecutor in those days. There were two parallel legal systems in Germany throughout the war, unlike a communist system. You had the traditional Roman law, which still functioned beautifully. The courts functioned normally. And then you had a parallel structure, which was the Nazi law. And the two didn't intersect. So you could have, obviously, Hitler wouldn't have been tried under Nazi law. They would have been, he would have been tried under existing, functioning civil, or rather, Roman criminal law.
So the courts, the civil courts, that existed before Hitler's rise still existed, still operated, and still could have been the avenue through which he was brought to answer for his crimes.
Would have been, should have been, could have been, yeah.
Okay, then how was Bonhoeffer, returning to Bonhoeffer, eventually convinced that this wouldn't work, but that, in fact, an assassination must take place?
Well, Bonhoeffer followed, at least this is how I see it, he followed the older Luther, who said, if the Beowulf comes into the village, then the peasants are under an obligation to slay him. If they don't slay him, they'll be held responsible for the consequences. That's the later Luther. The earlier Luther was against any form of tyrannicide. And Bonhoeffer, seeing what, especially since with his intelligence connections, military intelligence connections, seeing how deeply the Nazi system had penetrated by then Germany, said, unless you chop the head off, there is no alternative. Since neither option worked, you know, it is, we can, I mean, I would certainly would not judge either Bonhoeffer or Goerdeler for their positions. Both positions were highly legitimate, I think. But it's a very curious thing, and one can consider that much later, how it is that tyrants like Hitler either died by their own hands or just in bed comfortably. I mean, look at all these guys: Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot. They all died in bed. I mean, the first one to actually get arrested, and God knows whether he's actually even going to be punished, is Saddam Hussein. I mean, that is quite an extraordinary event. So one has to really see these developments also from a theological perspective, and that is really from the perspective of the immense power of Satan in our world. And this is what we've experienced in Germany.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Christian civil government, and godly resistance to such government, kind of sorting out some of these ethical issues when it comes to how Christians behave in the civil realm. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. Uwe, this is a question that has kind of come back around for me many times when it comes to Bonhoeffer's actions in Germany before he was executed. Was he ethically comfortable with the assassination of the Führer? Or was this always something, as I've heard one Bonhoeffer scholar say, it was always for Bonhoeffer the lesser of two evils. It was a sin committed for the sake of preventing greater sin, greater evil in the world.
Precisely. He was actually a pacifist, you see, Bonhoeffer was. And he was asked about this. And he said, yes, Christ saying that those who take up the sword will die by the sword applies to us too, that meaning the conspirators. And that for the first time, as he was pondering this, he realized what Luther meant when he said sin boldly, but even more boldly, believe and rejoice in Christ. And he actually expanded on this quite significantly when he said, you know, we believe it is our faith that God will forgive us sinful behavior if we do this because reason dictates to us to do that for the better of the nation. And if we err, then we still have to go to the cross. But we always do anyway. But it was not typically Bonhoeffer type way of thinking. To kill, because he, as I said, he was a pacifist. There's also a very interesting other aspect in this, and I know I'm going to get a lot of wrath from that, but I don't care. Bonhoeffer represented a class of European, I don't know specifically of German, that is almost extinct by now, and that is the type of upper class, the noblesse oblige. Type upper class. He saw the rabble that followed Hitler, and on the one hand, and the communists on the other, because they were pretty close in their behavior. And he saw the consequences. He was smart enough to see that. And he was brought up, his grandmother, for example, it was Julie was her name, who in her 90s defied stormtroopers who picketed Jewish shops, and she said, I am going through here and I'm going to shop with the Jews. You're not going to tell me where to shop. This is simply wrong. So there was also that element that a Christian mentality or an upper class mentality that was formed, obviously, by Christianity, in this particular case, Lutheran Christianity, was also at stake. I personally believe I wish we still had these classes about. You know,
it was part of Hitler's design with kind of his public works that he would send a man at 18 to go labor for 2 years, building you know, the infrastructure of Germany, rebuilding the infrastructure of Germany, to destroy the classes that existed in the German state.
Oh yeah, Hitler was a Leninist. Hitler wanted to destroy the class society. He wanted to replace. He wanted to kill off those who didn't quite fit in racially, and as for the rest, he wanted to have a sort of collectivized society. Hitler was not, contrary to what many people, especially on the American left, for example, claim. Hitler was not a right winger. He was not akin to conservatives. He was akin to the communists, and in fact, he was an avid reader of Lenin's works.
We're talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Nazi Germany, the time in which this theologian found himself, a time of necessitating resistance against governmental authority, the Nazi regime. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist, director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, and he's author of a forthcoming article in the Lutheran Witness titled Welcome Home, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We're talking about this. I invite your questions and comments when we come back, about 10 more minutes with Uwe. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or contact via our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe continues to score big at the box office. But what do we know about the author of The Chronicles of Narnia? How did C.S. Lewis's formative years help create this great writer, thinker, and educator? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. This new book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or find out more about Irrigating Deserts on our website, issuesetc.org. What can modern education learn from the educational philosophy of C.S. Lewis? How important is it to shape both head and heart? Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education by Dr. Joel Heck. The cost is $22.99. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Irrigating Deserts, our Issues Etc. book of the month for January.
Secular humanism. It's actually a religion.
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible Upholding Ministry of Answers in Genesis.
Well, Ken, most people probably don't think of religion when they hear the words of secular and humanism, but you're saying it's a religion.
Well, humanists believe the universe is self-existing and wasn't created. Now, they believe that man, as a part of nature, has emerged as a result of a continuous process of material causes. You see, secular humanists believe that nature is all that exists, that there's no God, no spiritual dimension, no afterlife. In short, they believe man evolved from molecules by natural processes. No supernaturals allowed. Secular humanists don't believe that an absolute moral code exists. Instead, they believe that man makes up his own rules. Now, secular humanists don't want to be called religious. That's because they don't want to admit that teaching materialistic evolution is really a religious point of view, a view that tries to explain life without God. You know, if they did that, it would be to admit that when public schools in America threw God out of the science classroom, they didn't throw out religion. They just replaced God with an atheistic religion. Sadly, many church leaders don't realize that when they support eliminating God from science classes, they're supporting an anti-God religion, the religion of atheism.
Many humanists like to try to stump Christians with questions like, where did Cain find his wife? For the answer to that old chestnut, visit our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
President Dean Wenthy on the future of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In every way, I can't believe the blessings that we have been given, as we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, He continues to lead talented and dedicated men and women to give their lives to Him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
To accept Dr. Wenthy's invitation for an on-campus tour at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Jim Eichhorst from Classic 99 about an opportunity coming up this next month to do something positive for your health. Cecil Murphy joins us as well to talk about how aging is an attitude. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany and godly resistance to governmental authority. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we will be joined by Ed Martin. He's an attorney in St. Louis. He'll round off today's program as we talk about this Illinois and Missouri situation involving pharmacists who are refusing in various venues to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. Ed Martin is involved in both the Illinois and the Missouri situation as it unfolds in the news. We'll get an update in about 10 minutes. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Steve is calling from West County. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing today?
Very well.
Hey, I want to kind of tie some prior conversations you've had about the rise of pietism and the rise of Nazi Germany.
All right.
And bring that fast forward to our day and time. And one of the things that kind of bothers me is the fact that so many Christians have wrapped Jesus in the flag that they are, and they've become so tied in with the Republican administration that they're unquestioning in their support. Mm. And my question is could that lead to the church acting in similar ways in the United States to what happened in Nazi Germany?
Steve,
I'll take it off the air.
And thank you very much for the question. So those who have at least apparently equated loyalty to, say, the present administration with Christian orthodoxy. I mean, you're not even a good Christian if you're not a Republican in the minds of some. Right. Your thoughts on this, Uwe?
Well, yeah, I think it's still a stretch. You know, I find this closeness between this particular administration and a branch of American Christianity uncomfortable, as I find it impossible to believe why, I can't understand why Democrats would have become the party of abortionists and sodomites, but I mean, that's another deal. What happened in Nazi Germany went far beyond uncomfortable relationships between or too comfortable relationships between the state and the church. This was a total collapse of civilized order. It was, as a friend of mine, who's 93, a Jewish friend of mine in Berlin, who is still active as a journalist, said, it was actually that the devil won over the hearts of people. And I think this is it. You have to look at the whole combination of issues. First of all, the charismatic personality of Adolf Hitler, the collapse of civilized society in Germany as a result of the end of World War, the loss of World War One, the economic crisis and whatever, and also the collapse of the type of class structure that existed in Germany at the time, which held the country together. I mean, you may debate whether a class society is a good one or not, but it certainly held the country, nation together, and propelled it to absolute heights of civilization. So I would not draw these parallels. There might be individual parallels, but as a whole, I don't see it.
There's one other resistance agent I think it's important to mention, and that is Kurt Gerstein.
Yeah.
And he was, in fact, at least to his superiors' knowledge, part and parcel of the Nazi effort. Yeah. But he was one who, in time, was able to, at least by the kind of information he was able to provide outside of Germany, see to it that the principles in the Nazi regime after the war met a just end at Nuremberg.
Yeah, no, he's an amazing character. Kurt Gerstein was actually was part of the Confessing Church movement, had been in a concentration camp, learned when he got out of the euthanasia program, the Nazi euthanasia program, killing mentally retarded people and people like that, and said the only way to find out about it is by actually going to hell myself and joining the SS, and so he became an SS officer and then got too much involved and was the first one to see the mass killings of Jews in Auschwitz or in Birkenau, and then came out of this shaking and tried to persuade the British and others of what was going on, and nobody wanted to listen to him. He met a Swedish diplomat on the train from Warsaw to Berlin, the guy transmitted that to his foreign office, but the foreign office didn't want to transmit it to England, because and those who did then in the end transmit it to England, the English didn't care. At the same time, Gerstein then went to the Vatican nuncio, the papal nuncio in Berlin, who kicked him out and said he was a bad officer and shouldn't have done so. And the guy got more and more involved, and then he was ordered to procure this Cyclone B, this terrible poison with which Jews were gassed. Then he misdirected trains so that the trains would got carrying this gas would get lost. Then when he was finally captured, he wrote an intense a lengthy report, first in French and then in English, for the French and the Americans, about his experiences. This report later played a key role in the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem. But Gerstein, having got so deeply involved in this evil, even though he was trying to fight it, ultimately committed suicide.
We have a call from Andrew. He calls from his car. Andrew, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. My question is there a connection between Martin Luther's anti-Jewish writings and Adolf Hitler? And then my second question is, what was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's response to Martin Luther's anti-Jewish writing?
Good question, Andrew. Very good question, in fact. Against the Jews and Their Lies is the most well-known diatribe of Luther, written late in his life about the Jewish people at his time. Do you draw a connection between that and the ideas of Nazism? And then how did Bonhoeffer respond to this already well-known doctrine?
There is only an indirect connection in that the Nazis themselves dug it up. The Lutheran Church had absolutely squashed it. And since the 16th century, that is, by the way, even in Luther's days, even Melanchthon was horrified by that. And secondly, of course, these were anti-Jewish writings, not anti-Semitic writings, because they were religiously anti-Jewish. Bonhoeffer, I'm not aware of anything Bonhoeffer, but might have written about this or said about this. I simply know that he himself was definitely not anti-Jewish, but from very early on, not only frequented Jews, he had a Jewish brother-in-law, he defended the Jews. He said, later on, he said, you know, if you can't weep for the Jews, you're not allowed to sing Gregorian chants. So Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran and very much a confessional Lutheran, at least from his own seen by his own light, had no connection with Luther's writings. And I must say, I was a child in Germany in those days, and I was brought up in a very Lutheran family. I have never heard of anybody in my family ever mention Luther's late anti-Jewish writings. This is something that the Nazis used. It is not something that the church, the legitimate Lutheran church, used.
Very briefly here, to return to the idea of vocation, you mentioned early on that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, given the opportunity to spend the better part of at least the latter part of the war, in the U.S., safe, sound, and probably living out the rest of his days in peace,
yeah,
chose to go back to Nazi Germany. You said he believed himself called.
That's right.
To do this, called to serve his fellow Christians and the European people. Your final thoughts on this?
Well, he felt called, and he jolly well knew that the cross was waiting for him, or might have been waiting for him there. He felt an obligation, as I used the old noblesse oblige metaphor here, to be a witness not just to his Christian faith, but especially also to the Christian society that had taken centuries to take shape in Europe. And he said he couldn't have faced himself in the mirror had he stayed in America, like many other intellectuals, and you can't blame him, Paul Tillich is one of them, and see Germany going to hell. So he was a patriot in that sense as well.
Tell us a little bit before we go, yeah, about you're going to have an opportunity to speak together with Dr. Charles Ford, another guest here on,
yeah,
our program, at an event that's going to highlight some of the thought of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. When is this going to happen? What's the detail here?
Yes, that's going to be in Fort Wayne, at the Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, this coming Friday and Saturday.
And you and Dr. Charles Ford are both going to be holding.
Yes, well, first there's going to be that famous Bonhoeffer film that will be shown, and Charles Ford will comment it. Then I'll give a lecture on Saturday morning, titled Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Bold Sinner. And then Charles Ford will discuss Bonhoeffer's relationship with the German resistance.
That's coming up this weekend. That's February 3rd and 4th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It is in observance of the 100th anniversary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's birth. February 3rd and 4th this week. The cost for attendance is $20. For more information on the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Conference, February the 3rd and 4th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, featuring Dr. Uwe Simonetto, our guest, and Dr. Charles Ford, call area code 260-452-2241, 260-452-2241. Uwe, thanks for being our guest again. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's director of the new Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, and author of a forthcoming article in the Lutheran Witness titled, Welcome Home, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. For the remainder of today's program, for about the next 15 minutes, we're going to get an update on the Illinois and Missouri situation regarding these pharmacists who are meeting with certain reprisals for refusing to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. Joining us to get an update, Ed Martin, an attorney in St. Louis. He's filed a complaint against Target with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission over the dismissal of a former Target pharmacist who refused to fill these prescriptions for the morning after pill. And he is also part of a legal team that filed suit last week in Madison County on behalf of four Illinois pharmacists who lost their jobs with Walgreens for refusing to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. Ed, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What's the overall situation here? The last time we checked in on this story, it was more or less an Illinois story involving Walgreens. They wanted their pharmacists to sign a pledge that they would fill these prescriptions for the morning after pill. What's the Missouri situation?
Well, we have so far at least one incident, one termination of a pro-life pharmacist, a woman in St. Charles who was not willing to dispense Plan B and other emergency contraceptives. And she was terminated when Target changed their policy. They had accommodated her for almost 5 years. They were very pleased to have her on their team. She was a good member of the Target staff. And she was terminated after some pressure put on Target by special interest groups and such. So it's very disappointing. And I think what your listeners should know is this issue of conscience, it's really coming into all of our lives. It's being attacked systematically by both the government and by private interest businesses. And our healthcare professionals need our support because it matters to us just as much as it does to them.
Okay, how did this all get started? Let's go across the river, if we could, to Illinois and Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah.
How did it all get started where suddenly, in a state where pharmacists, I believe, have right of conscience regard to these things, they found themselves at the wrong end of terminations or suspensions?
Well, it is a bit of a long story, but the brief synopsis is Governor Blagojevich on April 1st of 2005 held a press conference. Standing next to him was the representatives of the national groups, Planned Parenthood and NARAL, Pro-Choice America, whatever they call themselves. And he said, there's an emergency. Women are being denied their contraceptives. I must act. And he put into place an emergency rule. It was a false emergency. There's no evidence that there were wholesale problems with women. There's really no evidence that the women that he cited were having problems. But anyway, the governor is very powerful. And in a state like Illinois, he put into place some rules that basically pressure pharmacies to have to manage the question of whether they can allow pharmacists to have their right of conscience. And what happened was the pharmacies like Walgreens and some others said, you know what, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. We're told by the governor we must dispense these drugs, you know, quickly and appropriately, et cetera. We're going to change our policy, and we're sorry. The little guy or little gal, the worker, loses out. And the real interesting detail is we have yet to adjudicate these in court. We have two laws, one on the books, the Illinois Rights of Conscience Act, and this governor's rule, and we need to have the court say why, you know, the governor's rule is not in violation of this existing law. I mean, we're trying to do that in Illinois.
What has the governor said, if anything, about that apparent conflict between the right of conscience law in Illinois and his emergency edict?
Well, he has changed his tune, not surprisingly, I think, as the arguments have ebbed and flowed. Initially, he was saying he didn't care. It was a matter of access for women, and women had this right to access, and I think probably he got a lawyer or two in his team that said there's no such right, Governor. You know, you're kind of making that up. Now he's changed his tune. He's saying that the Illinois Rights of Conscience Act does not cover pharmacists. But if you read the plain language of the law, it says all health care providers are afforded protection for their rights of conscience. There's really no ambiguity there. Now, there is some history of floor debate in the legislature when they passed this law of some people saying pharmacists may or may not be covered, but that's not how the law is read. We don't read our laws based on discussions by legislators unless there's ambiguity, and there's not ambiguity. So the governor is playing a political game. He's very clear about it. I mean, you'd have a press conference and talk about public health and have Planned Parenthood and NARAL standing next to you. I mean, it's transparently a pandering, you know, up to these special interests, and it's a real breathtaking overreach of government. I mean, it's really disturbing.
What about the business side of this? Both Walgreens and Target seem to be acting in anticipation of something.
Yeah.
In that they're willing to lose. It sounds like, at least in the case of Williams, the Missouri employee at Target, valued employees over this.
Well, and that's the interest. Again, that's an interesting part of this. Well, in Illinois, you can see the businesses in more clearly why they're acting. There have been now Walgreens stores in northern Illinois that have been charged by the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation with violating the governor's rule, and they've been fined. So they're saying, we don't want to be fined. But in Missouri, what's really breathtaking is the store where Heather Williams worked, from which she was fired, did not even stock Plan B because the pharmacy supervisor didn't like it either. And so they didn't even have it in the store. And the reason they didn't have it and Target didn't care was they weren't getting hundreds of these scripts a month. They were getting none. I mean, it was over the course of 5 years, Heather Williams had two occasions to have someone bring it up on the phone. So it's not a financial, it's not a real winner for Target. And I think the reality is they gave in to pressure from these special interests, and they think that the public doesn't care about, you know, religious freedom and the loss of these conscience rights. So I hope people will pay a little bit more attention to it and get a little more motivated.
Ed Martin is our guest. He's an attorney in St. Louis. He's involved in both an EEOC complaint that is filed against Target in Missouri on behalf of a pharmacist dismissed there, and also a part of the legal team that filed suit last week in Madison County on behalf of four Illinois pharmacists who lost their jobs with Walgreens. What is the nature of the Missouri EEOC complaint?
Well, I mean, basically, because Missouri does not have a conscience protection, a law like Illinois has, it's harder to make a state claim. We're going to probably consider making a claim based on religious discrimination and free exercise and some other claims under state and federal law. You file an EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint. It's kind of a charge of discrimination. It's a necessary precursor to certain types of federal lawsuits under civil rights acts and other things. So it's kind of an opening salvo, and we're now kind of sitting back, figuring out what's next and where to go. I will say for Heather Williams, you know, people think that she's trying to, or you know, myself and others are trying to change things and trying to, you know, push certain agenda on people. What Heather Williams most wants is for Missouri to pass a law to protect rights of conscience for pharmacists so that she and others can work. When she was fired, Target said to her, if a law existed in Missouri that protected your conscience, we would like to keep you. We really would. And maybe if it passes, we'll be able to hire you back. Now, that's a chicken way out for Target because there was nothing saying they had to fire her. They just didn't like Planned Parenthood and others threatening them. So it's a very strange time and really a concern. I'm with a group called Americans United for Life, and we're now involved in 11 of these cases across the country. We're working in about 9 state legislatures to pass laws to protect conscience. We're working in the federal courts on fighting RU486's approval by the FDA. There's a lot of important work to be done right now in these areas.
And what can you tell us about the Illinois lawsuit filed last week?
Well, I'll tell you, I want to tell you two things, Todd. I appreciate the chance to talk because I want to update you. I'm actually the lawyer for two pharmacy owners because the rule was really targeted at pharmacies, putting pressure on pharmacies. And these two independent pharmacy owners, one gentleman is a Catholic, the other is a Protestant, they own their own pharmacies, and they're saying, we don't want to do this. That suit is on appeal. We're in the 4th Appellate District in Springfield. Appealing, fighting directly to the governor. We lost on a motion regarding standing because the court said my clients were not being hurt yet. But that's an important case because that's really what these Walgreens and others should do, is push back at the governor and not let him bully them around. But in Madison County, we have four pharmacists who were clearly wrongfully terminated under state law and probably under some federal laws for doing their job. Walgreens came in and said, we don't want to let you do your job, we don't want to accommodate your right, and we're firing you. So, you know, turnabout is fair play. We find ourselves in a plaintiff's seat in the probably one of the worst judicial spots for defendants in Madison County, Illinois. And in this case, I take great comfort in the fact that Walgreens is sweating a Madison County lawsuit because, you know, we expect, like other plaintiffs, to probably have a sympathetic ear. But more importantly, you know, most of these pharmacists are good, hardworking people. They get jobs again quickly. They're very well-trained healthcare professionals. They mostly want to be treated like the professionals they are, and this is very demeaning.
Is this going to be an issue as we face an election year, especially for the governor in Illinois?
It's definitely a political issue, but I'd like to put it in a broader context because I really believe that the issue of conscience and how we understand our religious freedom and the ability to act in the ways that we believe our faith calls us to is really a front on the war over secularization in our society. And in healthcare, it's particularly troubling because it often has to do with life and death. You know, end of life is going to be a big issue. You know, certain types of research around embryonic stem cell, that's another place. Certainly the beginnings of life and abortion and all, eugenics. And this issue is not, you know, the fabric of our country is tied up in how we relate to each other. And when we start to eliminate conscience and say, leave your conscience at the door when you enter the public square, it's a very dangerous time, and it's very concerning, you know, education and all kinds of fields. So I think it will be a political a fight for Governor Blagojevich, but I think you'll see when we talk about the important issues of the day, health care and others, conscience, we can't leave this question of religious freedom behind in conscience.
Ed Martin is an attorney in St. Louis. He has filed a complaint against Target with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission over the dismissal of a former Target pharmacist who refused to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. He is also part of the legal team that filed suit last week in Madison County on behalf of four Illinois pharmacists who lost their jobs with Walgreens and involved in a case on appeal with two pharmacy owners in Illinois as well. Ed, thank you for being our guest.
Todd, thank you, and I enjoy the show. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, we're going to keep on following this one because I agree with him. This is not just something isolated to Illinois or to Missouri, but has become and will become, I think, a nationwide issue, and that is the issue of conscience and the exercise of religious freedom, not only in healthcare but elsewhere as well. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is going to join us, our good friend and a regular guest. We're going to review a recent interview we did with Dr. Bart Ehrman, who had written that book, if you remember. The book's called Misquoting Jesus, calling into question basically all of the New Testament. We'll see what Dr. John Warwick Montgomery has to say in response to some audio segments from that interview with Dr. Ehrman. We'll also continue our series on Eastern Orthodoxy tomorrow on the program. Dr. Gene Smith is going to join us, a former Orthodox deacon and priest. And we'll review Rabbi Yekiel Eckstein's sermon preached yesterday at Ted Haggard's New Life Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. All that tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.